This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. We're talking about filing your income taxes on the show today, and our tax expert, Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals, is back for the last time this tax season. So if you've got questions, you better call now. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can send an email to ideas@WPR.org. Mary, thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Jill. It's nice to hear your voice.
Well, thank you. Yours, too. And I know you're super busy right now, so we appreciate that even more. And we've got a caller already, so let's just go right to Ken in Eau Claire. Hi, Ken.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Go right ahead.
My question is about 529 plans. My son has a 529 plan, and he's not going to go to college. And from my understanding, I've read that you can withdraw the money that the 529 was started with tax-free and penalty-free. So my question is can I just make a withdrawal from that account for the initial money and not have to pay taxes on that?
That's a good thought, Ken, but no, it doesn't work that way. Any money that you take out of the plan will be part your money and part earnings on the plan. If the money is not used for education purposes, it is subject to income tax on the earnings portion of it and subject to a penalty on that. However, there is relief starting, I believe, in 2023. It was part of the Secure Act 2.0 that was signed at the end of the year that says if the money's been in there for, I believe, for 15 years, and I would do research on it, but you are allowed to move that money to a Roth IRA for the beneficiary. Now, again, if you take money that has not had taxes paid on it, that part of the money will be subject to tax. That would be the earnings, but there wouldn't be any penalty on it. So, yes, you can take it out, but there are tax consequences. You, the person who put it in, can certainly take it out with the tax consequences I mentioned, or if it meets the conditions of the new law, it can become the Roth IRA of the person who chooses not to use it. Also, remember that it can be rolled into another family member's name in case there's another family member that may be able to use that money.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for that question, Ken. We got an email from Ben, Mary. He says he hasn't received some of his W-2s yet, and one is from a company that no longer exists. The company they contracted for ended their contract. All their accounts are closed or deleted, and the owner has declared bankruptcy, and there's just no means of contacting anyone at this former employer. So how does he go about receiving a W-2?
That is a great question. First of all, there is a form that is called a substitute W-2, and off the top, I don't remember the number of the form. I'll see if I can find it while we're looking. But if you create a substitute W-2, you can file it, and I believe you won't be able to file it electronically. You may have to mail it in. But you can create, it is a form 4852 is a substitute W-2. So hopefully he has some record of what he earned during the year. And that substitute W-2 will serve as the guide for it. If he has no record of what he's earned, then one other place to go is to go to the IRS website. If this person, the company, did file their reports the way that they should have, and that's a big if, you may be able to get a copy of it from the IRS, from the transcript account in your name. How soon that's available is questionable right now. I don't know how much they've had time to process and put in there. But I would try the substitute W-2 way and hope that the taxpayer has kept a record of what they've earned.
Okay, thanks for that email, Ben. Let's go back to the phones. Bob in Madison has a question. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I have a question related to, I am with a band that's been newly formed, and we are going to be performing at a city-sponsored festival this summer. And the city requested that we complete a W-9 form. Now, we're going to be making less than the reportable amount, which is $600, so I'm not worried about that end of it. But we have not dealt with this before, and on the W-9 form, it gives a few options in terms of identifying your type of setup, like LLC, partnership, trust. And we're, you know, we're the city will be essentially contracting with us, and so I was wondering if you have any suggestions about how for us to deal with this W-9 form.
Okay, Bob, Mary.
It's a good question, Bob, and just a couple of things that I want to remind people of, because your situation is not unique. When people have small businesses on the side, band being something like a business of providing entertainment, when you play for someone, somebody in that band is generally paid. And a lot of times what I see is that one person in the band collects the money and then divvies it up among the other band members. A W-9 form is a form which asks for the ID number of the person or entity that this group is making this contract with, if you will. The fact that this is a city doesn't make any difference. It isn't any different than if you're contracting with a local entertainment facility or a restaurant or something like that. Someone, if this band has not formed a formal entity, and a common type of entity might be a partnership, if they have not formed a partnership and have an ID number for that partnership, then generally the band leader acts as the representative of the band. And the band leader would give the W-9 form in the name of the band to that entity. That person would receive the tax documents, and then that person would include that on their return, but they should do corresponding nominee documents to the other people in the band. You mentioned the $600, and I want to address that. The $600 is the requirement that a 1099 NEC, which is the form that would go out from the organization. You are an organization that pays someone is required to do it for $600 or more. They can do it for less. They are trying to do the right thing business-wise with the W-9. And what I like to remind people of that sometimes they don't want to hear is that just because something is under $600 does not make it non-taxable. Any money you receive for doing something is a taxable event, whether it's $100 or $500 or $700, it still is a reportable event with or without documents. So I hope that helps to know what the norm is for the W-9.
Okay, thank you so much for that call, Bob. First one on a band I think I've heard. Let's go next to Deborah in Franklin. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had a question on doing Roth conversions in 2023. Most of the income my husband and I get is from Social Security and pensions, and then a little bit from dividends and income. when I tally up those amounts, particularly from the Social Security and pensions, to determine if we're going to stay under a certain tax bracket, do I use the amount before taxes are taken out or after?
As far as the Social Security that you're talking about, the Social Security that you're using is the gross Social Security before anything's taken out of it. But keep in mind that whether that's taxable, and the number that you're really looking, if you're deciding how much room do I have to convert without either creating a tax or moving to a higher tax bracket, you're looking at the taxable part of the Social Security. So to determine the taxable part of the Social Security, you include the gross Social Security with your other income and follow the formula to determine how much of it falls into the taxable category. And that with your other income gives you the idea of how much is left before you get to that next bracket that you're looking at.
Okay, thank you, Deborah. Appreciate that. And we also got a call from a listener who has celiac disease, which can only be treated with 100% gluten-free diet. And so there's extra costs on groceries each week. And she's wondering if someone with celiac can itemize their deductions, and could these costs be considered a medical expense and be written off?
That is certainly a good question. Generally, food for a diet is not part of a medical deduction. I think it would be very unusual that it would be. Now, I have not ever done it with it, and I certainly would look for some case law to see if there is anything specific. There have been times where there have been diet programs that you look at, and I know the courts have ruled if it's normal food that you have, that doesn't count. The diet program, the Jenny Craig type or whatever it is that you're paying for, not the food, is what goes on it. I would think it would go more in that pattern than it would allowing you just because of the medical condition. Remember that for medical deductions, for the most part, it is medicines or equipment that is needed that are deductible, and they have to be prescribed by a doctor, not something that is over the counter. So without looking at a specific case, my thought would be that you're not going to be able to do it.
Okay, thank you so much, Mary. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Clara Neipert is our on-air producer today, and Tyler Ditter is our technical director. We're talking with Mary Mellum, a tax professional and enrolled agent. Do you have questions or comments about your taxes? Join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And we have open lines, so give us a call. Tom in Watertown is on the line. He has a question. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I was planning on e-filing this year. And I got to the, we're over 73,000, and we've got like a Schedule F and a depreciation form, and I think it's a Schedule B. Can you still e-file, or how do you go about that?
Well, Tom, the answer is easy for me. I can e-file it, but I'm a tax professional. So I am guessing that you are working through some software, that online software. I don't know if it's a free file program or if you've used, you know, something that you've purchased. They may have certain requirements that say you can't do it. But it is not the government itself that is preventing you from filing your tax return with those items. So it would be your own software, which I don't know the type or anything about it as far as what you're getting outside.
Does that help, Tom?
Oh, I was just, I just made out the paper forms, and I thought I'd try email, e-filing, and I got to that 73. Can I go to a tax preparer and have them e-file for me?
Well, here's my answer to that as well. If someone comes to me to ask, will you e-file the return I have already done, my answer would be no. And my answer would be no because I have liability by being the ERO that transmits that return. I'm liable for what's on it. My answer to a person like that would be, if I were to e-file the return, I would have to be the one doing the return, and normally that person would be charged in the same way that anyone else that was coming in would do it. So I don't think you're going to find a paid professional that is going to just e-file the return that you've done.
Okay, thanks so much for the call, Tom. Let's go to Osseo. Hi, Mike.
Hello. I'm a pastor, and I take some money out of my salary to put into my IRA that's church-sponsored, the church-wide sponsored. And so I don't pay tax on that, but I pay Social Security. But then when I make out my taxes, I don't get credit for the money I take out. Is there a reason they did that, and are they going to change it so I can get credit for the money that I earned and then paying Social Security on?
Okay, that's an interesting situation. I am familiar with pastor taxation, so it sounds to me like the church is giving you this money and you can do what you want with it. Is that, or are they setting it up, I guess, is it part of your wages? Or is it part of your housing allowance? Or tell me a little bit more about how it happened.
It's part of wages. It's part of my salary. I'm taking it out, and then the congregation pays it directly to the insurance, to the retirement, I believe it's a 403. So they pay it directly, so I have nothing to do with it. And so I don't pay tax on it, but I pay Social Security.
Tom, you used a different term again. You used 403B. If it is a 403B, it should come off and you not pay taxes on it. So I think that you need to go back to your organization and see exactly what you're dealing with. And let me just give you kind of a quick overview. The way pastor's taxation works, and I'm sure you know this, but maybe our audience doesn't. As a pastor, you have two parts to your salary. You have the salary that comes in as taxable and a portion of that salary that is allocated to housing allowance. The housing allowance, to the extent that you use it for housing, meeting the conditions that go along with that, it is not subject to income tax. The other is subject to income tax. And all of it, both taxable and non-taxable, is subject to self-employment tax. Special rules for pastors. If you as a pastor used some of the money that you received as taxable income and put it into your own IRA, that would be deductible on your tax return. The fact that it is going from the church and you use the term 403B, which is the nonprofit's 401k, if you will, that has a different pattern to do it. And generally, it's not a 403B or a 401 contribution is subject to Social Security, but is not subject to income tax. So again, it depends on what program and how it's been done. And people who play into 401ks pay Social Security on the 401k money. They just don't pay income tax on it until they take it out of the program.
Okay, thank you so much for that call, Mike. We did get an email from Robert in Oshkosh. He says he knows that qualified dividends receive the more favorable capital gains treatment. How and where does he report this on his Wisconsin form?
Okay, first of all, qualified dividends are not a Wisconsin issue. Qualified dividends are a federal issue, and it is the qualified dividends are dividends that meet certain conditions, and when those dividends meet certain conditions, they are taxed for federal purposes based on the capital gain rates. Wisconsin has a different set of capital gain rates, and Wisconsin tax dividends as ordinary income, and they tax capital gains other ways. So there is a confusion for Wisconsin purposes. Federal, you get benefits of qualified dividends. In Wisconsin, dividends are regular income. So I hope that answers his question about the Wisconsin side of it.
Okay, sounds good. Next is Janet in Harvard, Illinois. Hi, Janet.
Hi. Can you hear me all right? I'm driving and on Bluetooth.
Yeah, we can hear you pretty well.
Okay. I was wondering whether the premiums for long-term care insurance are a deductible expense.
Yeah. The answer to that for federal purposes is yes. The catch is that you have to be able to itemize and meet the medical 7.5% test. That's federal law. For Wisconsin purposes, long-term care is an automatic dollar-for-dollar deduction. For Illinois, I do not know the answer to that.
Okay, thank you, Janet. Mary in South Range will take you next.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
The question is, if there are joint owners of a savings, checking, or CD, and the owners are not spouses, who does the IRS hold responsible for the interest or dividends earned? Does it matter who's listed first on the account?
It's a good question. If you are joint owners, and usually joint owners mean 50-50 ownership. I know we can get into the idea of joint with joint tenancy, joint owners, tenants in common, and all of that. But for this purpose, we're going to talk about it being joint owners. Both people are responsible for owning, for reporting their share. That being said, the catch is that when you have a joint account, there is usually one person's name that is primary, and that person's social security number, while both names are on the account, it's one social security number that they generate the tax forms in. So if you have joint owners of an account, the technical way of doing it is reporting all of it on the person who gets the 1099 or gets the account information, and that person should make a nominee distribution, do the same 1099 form they received from them to the person that it belongs to. And that person gets their half of it. The other person reports the whole thing, subtracts out the part that they sent to the other person, thus having their half on their return, and the other person has the document for the other half. That's the technical way to write, to do it.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Mary. And Chris in Duluth, you're up next.
Yes, I had a question regarding married filing jointly versus single filing. Our last child has left the house, so good news, we don't have that on our payroll anymore. But on a tax situation, we had to pay in last year, and it looks like we're going to pay in again this year, and we're trying to avoid that. Would, even though we're married, filing singly, each of us help avoid that?
Chris, are you in Minnesota? Are you a Minnesota resident or a Wisconsin resident?
Minnesota.
Okay. Because you're a Minnesota resident, things are different than they are in Wisconsin. As far as, because Wisconsin is a marital property state, kind of a community property state where a married couple has everything basically divided in half. In Minnesota, it is not a community property or a marital property state. So you can file married filing separate, not single, but married filing separate, and each person reports the income that is their exact income. Sometimes in a non-marital property state, if one person has lower income than the other, they can maybe save some taxes by the reporting. The best thing that I can say to you is that you need to test the waters. For federal purposes, there are some differences. Married filing separate is not equal to married joint in half. There are some things that you can't do as a married separate return that you could as a married joint return. And it all depends on your particular situation. In the state of Wisconsin, a lot of times because things have to be divided equally, it is not beneficial to file married separate. But I would recommend that based on your circumstances, you check it out.
Okay, thanks for that call, Chris. We have our lines open. If you've got a question, give us a call. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Mary, we had our pastor call back. He had another additional question that we didn't get to, or he didn't get a chance to ask. He said he doesn't get a housing allowance and pays for that himself, and he pays Social Security on that. But when he pays taxes, he doesn't get a credit for Social Security. Why does the federal government do that, and are they thinking of changing it?
Okay. I'm not sure I quite understand the question about getting a credit for Social Security. On a normal return, any Social Security, the housing allowance is a separate issue that I'm not sure why he doesn't get housing allowance, and that, again, is a congressional part of it. But a normal person who is self-employed, which a pastor is considered self-employed for tax purposes, they are, it's called a dual status employee. They get a W-2 and they pay taxes on the wages, but it's all subject to Social Security. So he gets a Social Security tax he pays, and anyone who pays Social Security tax, self-employment tax, does get a credit for half of the self-employment tax as a deduction. And that's the way it is for anyone, pastor or otherwise, that is self-employed. It's an adjustment to income for half the self-employment tax. In answer to the question about do I think it's going to change, I don't think it's going to change. And if things change for the pastor, they would be changing again, not to the benefit of the pastor, probably. And there has been legislation that has been tried to take away the housing allowance over the years. Nothing has succeeded yet, but I don't expect it to be any more beneficial in the future.
Okay, hopefully we got that all taken care of there for you, Mike. Otherwise, it might pay to talk to a professional about that. Let's go to Wanakee. Hi, Dave. How can we help you?
Hello. I was calling about the W-4 form where you kind of claim your exemption. My wife is taking a job, kind of a, almost like a little more than a volunteer job, with pretty minimal income for the year. And the form said that we need to both review our W-4 withholding, and I'm curious what, it's hard to figure out how that works anymore.
Dave, that's a very good question. I'm going to give you a quick answer to this, and then I'll say more about it. If I were your wife, I assume that you're the primary breadwinner, if you said she has this as a little more than volunteer job, I'm assuming she does not have an additional job to that.
Right. Yes, correct.
That being said, any money she does make puts a drain on the withholding that you have. The best way, or the way to have the most withholding taken out, short of saying take an extra $10 out, is for her to claim married filing separate. Now, that has nothing to do with how you file your tax return. But on the W-4, check the box that says married single or married separate. It just means that's the column that's going to give you the most potential taken out. And then go to step two where it says, I have multiple jobs or my spouse works, and check that box. That will give you the most potential taken out of her wage without going to line 4C and say, take out an extra $10 or whatever. The implication that it is saying to you with the check the spouse is saying that if you have two people working, the need for more withholding is greater when you have two people working. So if both people check the box on in that second step, then you will be taking out the most out of your check that you can in a standard form without looking for other numbers just to add in. I know that's kind of a complicated way of doing it. The W-4s have changed. We used to do things like saying single and zero, and that's going to take out the most. But there are only two columns now in a normal payroll chart. And to get to the second greater column, you have to check that second box in step, or that box in step two. So I recommend she take as much as possible that she can do. When you file your tax return next year, if there isn't enough withholding, then go back and take a look at either you increasing yours or she having a certain extra dollar amount for your shortfall.
Okay, thank you so much, Dave. Gary in Ripon, what's your question?
Yes, good morning. I have an IRA, not a Roth IRA, and I received a minimum required distribution for the first time for tax year 2022. Now, the company sent me a Form 1099-R, which indicates that I should declare the whole amount as taxable income. Why would that not be a capital gain since I actually paid a certain amount to get into the fund in the first place?
Okay. It's a good question. It is clearly not a capital gain. It is not property that you have sold. Traditional IRAs are retirement programs. They're substitute for wages that you earned while you're working. It's kind of a thing. Your wages while you're working are ordinary income, and that's why your pensions when you get them, or IRAs, are ordinary income. That being said, you paid money to get into the IRA. Traditional IRAs, for many people, are deductions. So if when you put the money into the IRA, you were able to take a deduction for that, you're just paying taxes on something that you really haven't contributed tax-wise to, because you got to deduct it. And you are drawing out that deducted amount plus any earnings that you've never paid taxes on. If you took a deduction for it, it's fully taxable. End of discussion. Now, if you made contributions to a traditional IRA and were not able to deduct all of that contribution, we call that a non-deductible contribution. There is a form 8606 that should have been done through the years that says this much of my IRA I already paid taxes on, and when I take it out, I will get a portion of that for every distribution I take out that is tax-free. So the only time you're not going to pay taxes on all of it is if you have made contributions that are considered non-deductible contributions, and you would use a Form 8606 to calculate that.
Okay, thank you very much, Gary. Mary Bellum is back with us today. She and her husband David operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals and are enrolled agents. What questions do you have about your taxes? Give us a call. Open lines, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Coming up tomorrow on Garden Talk, Mark Dwyer will be back with us to talk about plants that have green flowers in honor of St. Patrick's Day. And, of course, he'll take your other gardening questions also. But right now, we're talking taxes, and we're going to go to Bruce in Milwaukee, who has a question. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. I am a long-distance / over-the-road truck driver. And my driver's license, my CDL license, is in Wisconsin. But I have sold all my property in Wisconsin, and I've been advised to move my residency to a state like South Dakota or Texas that doesn't have a state income tax. So my question is, my company that I drive for is from Texas, and I understand that I will be taxed on that Texas income in Wisconsin. Do I have time to change my residency this year before the tax deadline?
Okay. First of all, let me ask the question of where do you go when you're not driving?
I live in my truck, so I'm wherever my truck is, and it can be all over the United States.
Are you an independent trucker?
No, I work for a company. I'm a company driver,
W-2 driver. How can you live in your truck? I mean, your truck doesn't have a shower in it. What I'm trying to get at is that Wisconsin will look at you as a resident of Wisconsin if you have any roots, any ties to Wisconsin. Your driver's license is making you a tie to Wisconsin. And they will look at where do you go to church, where do you go to the doctor, where do you do those things. That's what you need to establish a residence. The fact that you have a driver's license with Wisconsin on it makes Wisconsin think that you have ties to Wisconsin. And until you do something to change that, you will be required to pay Wisconsin income tax on that income. To change to another state like Texas or Florida or any of the states that do not have state income taxes, you need to set up residence and ties to that state. And no, you can't go backwards if you haven't done it already. So it isn't a game that says, I don't want to pay taxes in that state. If you want to get the benefit of not income tax in that state, then you've got to arrange ties to that state more than just the company is there. Change your driver's license, establish a relationship with doctors, have an apartment there, something of that nature to make that happen. And when you make that happen, it will be from that date forward that your income is no longer taxed to the state of Wisconsin and is subject to that place.
Okay, so if Bruce gets this residency changed tomorrow, then he still is going to owe Wisconsin taxes for the first couple of months.
He would be considered a part-year resident of Wisconsin, and prorated-wise, the income earned up to that point is Wisconsin income, and the income earned after that fact is whatever state he chooses to be in. And then the next year, when he has a full 12 months of residency in that state, then that's how he will not have to pay taxes to Wisconsin. Wisconsin is very good at looking for its citizens. So keep that in mind. There have been many cases where things have been challenged, and they look at where's your vehicle registered, where do you go to church, where do you see your doctor, where do you have any ties, and that will tell you where you're a resident of.
Okay, thank you so much, Bruce. Next up is Angelica in Beloit. Hi, Angelica.
Hi. I'm calling regarding my daughter, who is on a Fulbright grant teaching in South Korea. And I don't quite know how to handle her tax situation. My understanding is that she's about 24, and I think they give her a stipend of about $18,000 a year. And I just wanted to get some advice as to how to handle that this year for her.
Okay. Is she a college student?
No, she has graduated from college.
Okay, so why is she getting this Fulbright scholarship? What is she doing to earn?
So she's teaching English. I believe it's funded through the State Department, and they consider these young adults as cultural ambassadors.
Okay. Generally, a Fulbright scholarship is non-taxable to the extent that it is representing tuition. And because tuition, scholarships to the extent of tuition are non-taxable. Anything above that or any money for services would be considered taxable income. You might go to, if you want more to read on, you might go to the IRS website. There is a publication on education that does have information about Fulbright scholarships. There is, depending on the place she's at, if she's there for more than for a 12-month period, there may be some foreign tax credit or foreign earned income exclusion that she might qualify for. But it is my understanding that if the reason she's receiving this Fulbright scholarship is because she's teaching, it's going to be taxable.
Okay, thank you, Angelica. Next, we'll take an email from Crystal in Oshkosh. She has about $45,000 in student loan debt, and she is in the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, and she has about four more years of qualifying payments before her loans are forgiven. A colleague suggested filing taxes separately from her husband so she qualifies for lower payments with income-based repayment plan. The payments are currently frozen due to litigation on the federal level. When they did this last year, he had to pay in several thousand dollars, and when filing together, they usually get a sizable refund. So how do you recommend that Crystal and her husband file going forward to minimize her student loan payments and not cost her husband in taxes?
This, Crystal, is a case of wanting your cake and eating it too. There are trade-offs, and yes, there is a program, there is the availability to file a separate return, and then you're judged with your repayment schedule on your income on the separate return. The bad part of it is married filing separate is usually the most disadvantageous portion. And if you choose to go that way, you have to weigh how much money are you saving on your student loan debt versus how much extra tax are you paying because of it. Again, if you're in Wisconsin And normally the Wisconsin rules for marital property say that if it's joint income, that you split it evenly between the two returns. The only way around that, if you happen to have lower income than your husband and do it based on just your income, you would have to have a marital property agreement with your spouse that says my income is mine and your income is yours to file just based on what you have and what your husband has. And for that, I would make sure I sought legal counsel in Wisconsin to find out how to do that. But it's trade-offs. If you're not saving enough money compared to the extra tax burden that you have, then file jointly and forget about the extra savings. Otherwise, you can't have them both.
Okay, thanks for that email, Crystal. Let's go back to the phones and Marsha in Stevens Point. Hi, Marsha.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
I go to four or five craft sales throughout the year. I pay a fee to be there, and then I sell things. And I don't collect any sales tax. I was told I didn't have to because I don't make very much money at those. So should I be collecting sales tax?
I believe that your sales are subject to sales tax, and you should have a sales tax number, and you should do the sales tax. Vendors in Wisconsin, if you are buying and selling products, you are subject to sales tax unless there's a specific exception for you. So I have seen that when sales tax is not done when it should be, Wisconsin is very good at coming in and assessing tax, and when that happens, it also includes interest and penalties. I don't know of any rule that I know of that says if sales tax is under this amount, you don't have to collect it. So I would encourage you to do a little research on sales tax in Wisconsin, because I believe that you're subject to it.
Okay, thank you for bringing that up, Marsha. Appreciate that. Anne in Wausau, what comments do you have?
Hello, I want to add a little more information about clergy housing allowance. I am a clergy person myself.
Oh, Anne, we're having a really difficult time hearing you. You're breaking up. Okay, so Anne, we're going to put you on hold, see if we can get a little better connection. And let's go to Dale in Rhinelander next. Hi, Dale.
Yes, good morning. I sold some stock last year that was held for quite a few years, so there was quite a gain on it, and that had to be taxed, of course. That's fine. And there was a minor penalty, which is fine. But my tax software printed out quarterly estimated tax payments that I should be sending throughout this next year. And since that was just a one-time event, am I required to do that?
Good question, Dale. And the answer is no. Your software is being proactive in saying that you had a balance due this year. To get rid of the balance due, one means is to pay more in quarterly payments. You never have to make quarterly payments as long as you realize that if you don't have enough withholding or estimated tax payments, the government will charge you a penalty. And so it's just being proactive. If this was a one-time shot for you and you normally are comfortable with a refund or a small balance due, then you don't have to do estimates.
Okay, does that answer your question, Dale?
Yep.
Okay,
thank you.
All right. Sounds good. So we've only got about a minute left or so before we have to go to a news break. But if you have a question, give us a call. We do have open lines, 800-642-1234. And again, email ideas at WPR.org. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. And coming up on Garden Talk tomorrow, Mark Dwyer will be back with us. He's going to talk about plants that have green flowers. We're going to talk about shamrocks, maybe some scent in the garden. So we'll have plenty to talk about there. And like I said, Mary will be back in just a few minutes or so. So hang on. And if you want, give her a call, 800-642-1234. Talking about income tax preparation on the show today. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for being with us on the Ideas Network. Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals is back with us. She and her husband David have been in the tax business for more than 30 years. They serve individuals, they consult other tax professionals, and teach tax seminars around the country. Join us with your questions by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas at WPR.org. So we've got a few callers on. Let's go right to Ann in Wausau. Hi, Ann.
Hi, I'm hoping to add a little bit of clarification to the clergy housing allowance conversation. In my experience, the clergy person can fill out a form and the number, I don't know, but it's very simple, and declare a portion of his or her salary as housing allowance. And then that person has to show receipts for everything that they spent on their home, such as cleaning products or furniture or, you know, anything to improve their house. And it's
for a minute. First of all, Anne, what you're saying about how it's calculated is one thing, but the clergy person does not have the ability to fill out a form and say, I want housing allowance. The housing allowance has to be set up by the congregation that the clergy person is working with. And the congregation has to set it up at the beginning of the time. And this works for congregations or called teachers in schools as well. But it is a preset amount, not something that a clergy can just say, I'm eligible for housing allowance. So I wanted to make that clarification before you.
Okay, go ahead, Ann.
In my denomination, we fill out that form prior to the coming tax year and take it to our administrative council or whatever the name of that body is in your congregation. And yes, they have to approve it, but they wouldn't know how much you would likely be spending on your housing without some input from the pastor.
I totally agree with that as far as it, what you've said, your congregation or your group may have the form that asks for that, but it has to be approved, pre-approved or set up by the congregation. That's in the law. It isn't something that they can just do. And congregations vary. Some of them have, the congregation itself or the group has a certain amount that they say, we'll only grant this amount. No matter what the pastor spends or whatever, they may say 50% of your salary is housing. Others may say, what do you want? And we'll approve that. So there is no set amount that says it is an agreement between the governing body, whoever it be, is the one that sets that amount. And after that amount is set, that establishes what the housing allowance is. And there's a three-step process that says your allowable non-taxable housing is the lower of the amount you've actually spent, the preset housing allowance, or the fair rental value of a furnished property. It is the lower of those three. And the IRS has clergy worksheets that have to go along with the tax return when it is sent in to verify all of this. So it's great clarification. Clergy taxation is very different than other taxations, but it is very important that it be established ahead of time and not to allow pastors to think I can just do this, because it doesn't work that way.
Okay, thank you for calling back, Anne. We appreciate that. Very complicated, isn't it, Mary?
Yes, pastor taxation is a whole art. Not all tax professionals deal with that or want to deal with it. And it's a neat field, and it provides benefits if it's done right.
Okay. Thank you again. And let's go to Hillary in Milwaukee. Hi, Hillary.
Hi, thank you. I have a question regarding a rental property. My husband and I own a home in Louisiana, and we rent it to tenants. We live here in Milwaukee, and we had a little mix-up with our taxes in the past, and I'm trying to gain some insight which state or states I should be filing with.
It's a good question, Hillary. I'm assuming you are a resident of Wisconsin.
I am, yes.
As such, Wisconsin is very territorial, like other states. But first of all of your income that you receive, no matter where it is subject to Wisconsin tax. If the property is located in Louisiana, you will also have to file a Louisiana state tax return. Wisconsin, and you will pay taxes on the income that is earned in Louisiana, just that part of your income. Wisconsin, on the other hand, says we give you credit for the taxes you pay to the other state. It's a form OS that you have to fill out as an attachment and attach a copy of the other state return so that they can verify it. So it is a Wisconsin return that will claim all of your income, a Louisiana that will claim only the income that is produced in Louisiana, and the interaction between those two will prevent you kind of from paying double tax, because you'll get a credit for some or all of the tax paid to Louisiana on the Wisconsin return.
Okay, thank you very much, Hillary. Let's take an email. Pat in Brookfield says that they gave a relative an interest-free loan for grad school of $160,000. Do they have to report anything to the IRS?
Wow. There are special rules that is called imputed interest, and there is a certain amount that you can do as a gift loan that is not subject to tax, but technically, if you exceed that amount, part of your loan is considered interest, and you should be paying taxes on it.
Okay, thanks. Oh, go ahead, Mary.
They need to do a little bit more research into, I believe it's codes 7872 is the IRS code section regarding that.
All right, great. Let's go back to the phone. But if you have a question, our lines are open, 800-642-1234. And we'll go to Milwaukee. Hi, Rich. What can we help you with?
Hey, I have a question as to deducting mileage that I drive for work. I keep a log. My company pays me a car allowance, but they just, and it's as a separate item on my pay stub, but on my W-2, it's lumped into my entire compensation. So I went through, you know, an online tax preparation service, and it says even though the 26,000 miles and my mortgage and property tax, I'm still better off taking the standard deduction. I don't see how that is.
Okay. First of all, let me understand. Your company pays you a housing, a rent, a car allowance, and it's subject to tax, correct? You said it was in your W-2.
Yes.
And you are an employee of this company, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Unfortunately, after beginning in 2018, the IRS, the law was changed to disregard employee business expenses. Prior to 2018, you would keep track of your mileage and you would have deducted your miles as a part of the Schedule A. There is no place on the Schedule A currently to do that. My recommendation to you would be to go back to your employer and ask your employer to change their change the way they do things and have it as a reimbursement policy. If your employer reimburses you for the miles that you have driven, it is not part of your W-2. It is because they give you a car allowance that it goes on your W-2. But short of that, you're stuck with the income and no place to make any deductions.
Okay, thank you, Rich. Ahmad in Fitchburg, you're next.
Hi. Can you hear me?
We can. Go right ahead.
All right. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for a very good program. My question is very similar to the previous one. In fact, I have paid a couple of thousand dollars for my trip to a company which I work in New York, which they have obviously compensated me for that. But they have put all those compensation with my salary in my W-2 form, which I have, the expenses have been paid from myself, which I have already paid taxes on that. So I just was wondering how can I reimburse or correct this problem.
How do you correct a W-2 form, Mary?
Well, first of all, there is no correction to it unless your company has a written reimbursement policy. If the company has a reimbursement policy that says, if you go on company business, turn in the receipts to us and we'll pay you back, if they have that policy, it should not have been in the W-2. So if they have the policy and inadvertently put it in the W-2, then they need to go back and reissue the W-2s with the correct amount. If they just pay you the money and put it in your W-2 and do not have this reimbursement policy, currently there is no place for an employee to deduct those expenses.
Okay, thank you, Ahmad. We'll go to Kathy in Madison. She's got a related question here. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, I think I screwed up because my daughter, like a dependent, W-2 came and it was in her nickname and not her legal name. So I sent it back to the corporation, a letter asking for a corrected W-2 with a legal name, and I haven't got anything back. Did I screw up?
I don't think you screwed up. I think you did the right thing as far as asking for a name correction. But as far as how soon they'll get it back to you, I don't know. The numbers are good, and if they don't get it back to you in a reasonable amount of time, maybe a substitute W-2. I think you're saying, how soon can I get this tax return filed?
Right, because I'm also on Obamacare, so, you know, they picky about getting the tax return filed, you know.
Sure. What I would suggest to you is
to give a call to the employer and ask if they received what you sent them and if they could tell you any kind of a timeline. And maybe you'll find that they aren't even going to issue a corrected one, and maybe you'll just file the way it is. Make sure that the W-2 or that the Social Security number on the form is correct.
Thanks, Kathy. And another W-2 question. We've got Bob in Cedarburg. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Thank you. Our kid made about $5,000 on a summer job last summer, and he never received the W-2. He asked for it, and he was told by the employer that he should be okay and didn't need a W-2, according to the employer. So we haven't gotten one for her, and we don't know how to handle this on taxes.
That is a wonderful response from the employer. I think from the employer's standpoint, they're probably saying he's under the filing requirement, there won't be any taxes. And that's fine, except anybody that employs a person as an employee is required to do a W-2. There's no minimum number for the W-2. I would recommend that you do the substitute W-2 that I mentioned, the form 4830, let's see, I remember the number again, 4852, that you do a substitute W-2 with that employer's name. I hope that you have his ID number and that kind of thing, and send in a substitute W-2 and file the return for your child. I'm assuming if he did not do a W-2, they didn't do any withholding or any Social Security.
Correct.
And is your son potentially going to college or anything that you might need a tax return for, or numbers for college aid or something like that?
No.
Okay, that's one of the reasons why I would want to do the filing. My only other concern with it, and maybe you should address it with or have your son address it, sometimes employers like to avoid Social Security, and they like to pay people as independent contractors. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I mean, you have to know the circumstance to know what's appropriate. But if your son was paid as an independent contractor, that $5,000 would be taxable to him. It wouldn't be subject to income tax if that's all he made, but it could be subject to payroll, to Social Security tax as an independent contractor. And again, I'm not making the judgment whether that's what they did or not, but if he received $5,000, no taxes taken out, they may view him as an independent contractor, in which case independent contractors are subject to self-employment tax even when their income tax is below the normal filing requirement.
Okay, thank you very much, Bob. We got a question from Carl in Oconto. He couldn't stay with us, but he turned 73 this June and has a company-sponsored 401k. Will he have to take a required minimum distribution this year? And the agency that's handling the 401k, will they automatically send him the required minimum distribution?
Extremely good question. Part of it is that the Secure Act 2.0 changed the minimum required distribution year to age 73 for anyone that had not turned 72 by December 31st of 2022. If Carl is still working for that company, he will not have to take a minimum required distribution, even though he is age 73. He can continue its deferral until he is no longer employed with the company that he has that 401k with. But if he is retired and turns 73, then he will need to take a minimum required distribution by April 1st of 2024. I say April 1st. It should come out in 2023, but the government, for the first year that you are required to take a distribution, gives you kind of a safety net up to April 1st of the following year. If you wait that long, you will be taking two distributions in that year, so keep that in mind. Now, as far as will the company tell them, the custodian of the 401k, I believe, is required to do one of two things: to tell you that there is a required distribution, and secondly, offer to calculate it if you want. They will not automatically, without your approval, send you the money, but they may tell you what it is. But they're required to tell you that you have one coming based on their information. It's up to you to make arrangements for it.
Okay, thank you very much, Carl. Let's go to Ken in Hudson. Hi, Ken.
Hello. Okay, I had a timber sale in 2021, and I did not receive a 1099 on that timber sale. I don't know if that's the correct form. I called the company a little while ago, and they said they had sent one, but I never received it. So anyway, I was just curious. The process is going to be, I'm going to have to, when I get that, I'll plug it into my tax, and I'll tax work this year.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Ken. Mary?
Okay. I'm not sure I understand, so I'm going to go answer the question based on my assumptions. I think Ken said that his timber sale was in 2021. If the timber sale was in 2021, it should have gone on the 2021 return. Oftentimes, timber sales come on 1099-S's or maybe a 1099 miscellaneous. At any rate, whatever is received should be taxable in the year received, not the current year. So in Ken's case, if he did not include it in 2021, he should go back and amend his 2021 return to include that timber sale. And I would do it regardless of whether you've got a document or not.
Okay, hope that helps, Ken. And sorry we couldn't get to everybody's question today. Mary, thank you so much for all the help that you give our listeners. We really appreciate it.
You are welcome.
And good luck with the tax season.
Thanks, Jill.
Okay, bye-bye. We've been talking with Mary Mellum. She and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals and are enrolled agents. Join us tomorrow again for Garden Talk in honor of St. Patrick's Day. We'll be talking about shamrocks and green flowers and take your gardening questions. Hope you can join us. I'm Jill Nadeau, in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network. Stay well.